Hello and welcome to Happy Times and Places, a Doctor Who episode commentary podcast in which a Doctor Who fan, played by me, Toby Haydoke, watches a story, commentates along to it, and tries to guess what his friend, who's also watching, has chosen as their favourite thing about each episode.
Hi, I'm Erica Lear, and I'm part of the Doctor Who Appreciation Society, and I also run my own Doctor Who conventions in the Northwest with the help of my long-suffering husband, Alan. The story I've chosen for Toby's amazing podcast is the Caves of Androzani, which is a big favourite of mine. Now, I've been briefed to choose favourite moments from episodes, from the episodes of Caves, so here we go.
Hello and welcome to Happy Times and Places. A jolly location where I try to accentuate the positive about Doctor Who, and it has occasionally been levelled at me that I often on the side of choosing obscure or not well-liked stories. That could be true, but you see, every story is a favourite of someone, and that's kind of the point. And I personally prefer it when I dip into other podcasts that talk about Doctor Who stories, like, for example, A Hamster with a Blunt Pen Knife, which I very much enjoy, or A Wheezing Groaning Sound, which is hilarious. I'm very interested when they sort of pick over the less digested stories. But popular stories are popular for a reason, because they're good and people like them, and perhaps people like listening to people talking about them. So, and everyone gets its moment in the sun, so I'm going to go for a story that, in, you know, the correct manner of Doctor Who stories, would be called the blowholes of Androzani Minor, and it's the Caves of Androzani, which, as you heard, has been chosen by Erica Edgerton, who is a lovely woman who is as mad as a bag of spanners, and I mean mad in a good way, not in a way that she'd, you know, stalk you and cook your pet rabbit, but mad in a kind of, which she's just bonkers, but good fun, and also has a heart of what Cherilee, my partner, would describe Erica as somebody who has a good soul, and both her and her husband Alan have been very nice to me over the years, and she also does sterling work with organising the Who at Hoylake Convention, and also the work that she does for Dwas. So she has chosen, both her and Alan were people I asked very early in the process, and they responded very early. So the reason Caves of Androzani has come so late is because I have held off. So maybe it's me that has a problem with popular stories, and I want to be talking about the you know, the less popular, the less obvious ones, because Alan and I, and they kind of, I was kind of like, oh, come on, guys, because I was always impressed when people chose a less popular story, a more interesting prospect for me. See, I'm giving myself away. Erica and Alan went for The Caves of Androzani and The Curse of Fenric, respectively, and I've not got round to either, because I was kind of, well, it's obvious what's good about them, but if it's obvious, I have to say it. And sometimes things that I think are obvious then turn out to be a surprise to other people, because things are only obvious if you think, you know, if you think them. So let's see if what I like about the Caves of Androzani chimes with what Erica likes about the Caves of Androzani, and indeed chimes like the incidental music heralding the regeneration of Peter Davison, with what you like about the Caves of Androzani. Erica, you know, I'll give you the heads up on this, has a rather, having said she's not mad in a stalkery way, she is rather too obsessed with Peter Davison for, I think, to allow the description of sane to apply to Erica and not be not have any of those involved sued in the Trades Descriptions Act. Yes, she's got a thing about Davison, shall we say. So I would be hugely surprised if any of the things that she chooses are not related to Peter Davison. I'm not going to let that affect my judgment. I wouldn't be surprised if Erica went, my favourite thing about episode one is Peter Davison. My favourite thing about episode two is Peter Davison. I love my Peter. But let's see here. My favourite thing about episode three is Peter Davison. but let's see. I only say this because I feel like this is friendly joshing. so let's see what I find to talk about the Davison of the Peter Davison of Androzani, and we'll check in with Erica at the end of each episode. I'm going to press play in 3, 2, 1. Now then, I didn't see these episodes when they went out because I had been sent away to boarding school, not because I was posh, in fact the opposite, but it may be where I picked up some of my enunciations. A charity paid for me to go and sleep at a school because Mum couldn't get me to and from the local school every day because she had to go back to work and worked miles away and had to be up early and couldn't do the transport, etc. Anyway, the reason this is relevant is because the local vicar had a video, and he would video Doctor Who for me, and then my mum on a Sunday, which is one of the 2 half-days I was at home every week, I would go to the vicar's, thank you, Reverend Michael Harding, and watch on his video, because not many people had videos in those days, the Doctor Who episodes of the week. But for some reason, we had to do something, or he was away the weekend of episodes 1 and 2 of Caves of Androzani, so I watched it all in one go, as an omnibus. So this has always felt a bit like a sort of Sunday afternoon movie to me. And it's got the feel of that as a production as well. But it's always had that kind of vibe to it. I feel sorry for Nicola Bryant because I've heard people give her stick for her pronunciation of the word glass, which she is clearly ribbing Doctor Who with that pronunciation. And it is because when they filmed this, they didn't know that the scene in the TARDIS, which was going to be done in the studio, where he refers to glass bottles, was going to be cut. And so presumably when they'd done that read-through or rehearsals or whatever, or talked about it at least, he was going to pronounce it glass. So she was going to then do this bit glass. And it's why this joke doesn't quite work, because we don't have the context. And they have done a bit of dubbing as the TARDIS lands with some of the lines that would have been in that TARDIS scene. But I see sometimes people use it as a stick to beat Nicola Bryant with for her non-American pronunciation of glass, which seems to me, even without the stuff around it, it seems to me, even without the context, the performance is suggesting that she is ribbing the Doctor's pronunciation. But Doctor Who fans will never pass up an opportunity to tell you you've done something wrong, even if you haven't done something wrong. So solidarity, Nicola Bryant, who is excellent in this story. This is a lovely shot here that we have. And obviously there's the mat at the background, which was slightly wobblier on transmission than it is on the stabilized versions. I don't know how you feel about that. I don't mind a wobbly horizon myself, but also I'm not over worried about that stabilization either. It's a great quarry location, but and yes, it's they're not caves, they're blowholes. It's not Androzani, it's Androzani Minor. It's one of my amusing things that amuses me that it's a story that isn't called what it actually is. Graham Harper is, of course, the big news with this story. It's his first one as director. Amazing that your first one, you get the kind of season climax. I know we have Colin Baker's debut as the actual climax of the season, but it doesn't feel like that in terms of what that production is like, but we'll talk about that when we get to the Twin Dilemma. This definitely feels like, where everything sort of climaxes with this season. And we have, of course, in a perfect Doctor Who story, brilliantly directed, brilliantly acted, brilliantly written, we have to have a bit that's naff, and it's the becloaked bat monster. Oh, it's not as bad. Have they reduced the micro? I think is it called microphony? The interference caused by machine gun fire that gives it that Venetian blind effect, which is the machine gun fire interfering with the electronics in the studio, which is why machine guns are problematic. I like that. And isn't this brilliant? Nice sort of polished surface. Nice caves here. They seem like sort of shiny stone. This is so we've had the machine guns. That's Graham Harper going, don't want lasers, I want machine guns. That I think automatically gives it quite a grown-up feel. And this I think is wonderful. This is the beginning of the end. Perry has an almost comedy tumble in this excellently lit cave set. I've just actually watched The Descent, this is how up to date I am. I'm recording this at the end of 2022, and it's a great shot, see, from above, lots of smoke, brilliantly lit, very well done. And the cave set, I thought it was shot on location, to be honest, until I then read up afterwards. Because what you do when you watch a film, isn't it? You then hit the internet to find out all the facts. He should have won an Oscar for those cave sets. And a great small-scale English sort of horror movie, British horror movie, although with an eclectic cast. Excellent. Love these characters. I love a mercenary in Doctor Who. It always made me feel a bit grown up as a kid. And all this stuff about picking chakors, which Terence Dix gives some background to in the book, saying he explains what they are. But Robert Holmes doesn't see the need to. It's basically, I've never been confined. It's like breaking stones. It's like being in a chain gang, picking chakors, which suggests that these guys are crims, that they want to avoid the law. This is beautiful. This is handheld camera work here. And he's trusting not to see the full face of the actors. I think we have a hand on a shoulder, do we? Yeah, beautiful. This is unlike anything you've seen in Doctor Who from a director in a very, very long time. Peter Grimwed, I think, is very good at picture composition and pacing and editing and all of this sort of thing. But this feels like, something out of nowhere. I was 10 when this was on, and I couldn't necessarily quite put my finger on what it was, but it did feel that this was, something, a bit more Sunday afternoon action movie, not just because of when I was watching it. And the pace and the cut, surrender, boom, cut. Music, Roger Lim is on absolute fire. It's the minimalist nature of the music. I think it's a shame the military are kind. I think it's. I can see what they're thinking with the military costumes, is that they're quite practical and they're sort of overalls. But they do look like they should be working on a building site or an oil rig, which are both practical places, but they don't give you quite the military feel that I would necessarily be after. And the actors are doing it nicely. Look at that beautiful light coming from the monitor. It's those little bits of attention to detail. And I love the fact that Chelak in any story would normally be the sort of either the heroic type or the stubborn base commander that eventually comes round. But as we discover, everyone's a bit morally compromised in this. Although Martin Cochrane is brilliantly, elected to play him as the sort of, typical military type. And I love the way that Robert Glenister sort of leers in the background. And it was fun seeing Robert Glenister in this as a kid, because we knew him as the other guy from the Peter Davison sitcom Sink or Swim. So that felt like an appropriate piece of casting for Davison's last story. That felt like that was being done to acknowledge the fact that that's what he'd been doing when he started as Doctor Who, or it felt like it at the time. I don't know exact dates. This is great. We haven't seen Morgus yet. And yes, I remember watching there, and I love that looking at the camera, and the little bit of eye wobble. I love a little bit of eye wobble. This camera is handheld again, which just gives it a slightly sort of juddery feel. I love the augmentation of the guns with those little gas canisters on, or whatever they were. And I remember when I got this a bit later and going, well, you know, why is... And in that, in the meantime, I'd seen polls that had voted Caves, you know, top. And I remember thinking, oh, really? A modern story is top? Is that better than things like Evil of the Daleks and classics like all of the Pertwee era and the Gothic, blah, blah, blah. And it was immediately apparent when I came to revisit it, you know, when I was getting videos some years later, that, oh, yes, the reason... That, and Graham Harper, I think, was winning polls as best director. And you go, oh, yeah, no, I can see. I can see why this is the story that has the reputation. And, I, you know, I like to think of myself as somebody that champions the underdog. And there's something quite cool about going, yeah, you know, that thing that everybody likes. I don't like it. I mean, I think, yeah, there's also something very tiresome about that. And actually, more people seem to want to be that sort of person now that actually I think I feel slightly as though that's not very, very cool anymore and is a bit irritating. But also one should never judge people's tastes and say, oh, you only like that or dislike that because of this. It might just be genuine. Well, I genuinely like this. I love this, the relationship here between the Doctor and Perry, where they've got this sort of dark humour. In fact, the dynamic. Oh, I love this. If we could talk about this misunderstanding in a civilised manner, I like that. And doesn't he say, and if we prove to be hostile, then fair enough. And I like the way that this escalates. And he talks about urticaria. It's just those little bits of wording as well that you know, give a clue to, you know, the Doctor being knowledgeable, but they also sound good. Robert Holmes is very good at choosing words that are suggestive through their sound, not just because of what they say and their meaning. You know, they're good on the ear as well as on the brain receptors, if you like. Is it accidental? And now John Normington's such an interesting actor because it's great piece of casting because, you know, he usually sort of played sort of fussy, funny little men, you know. And so to cast him as this horrible fascist. And I mean, is it a coincidence that he's got the slightly sort of domed forehead and slightly staccato delivery nasal thing of Norman Tebbit going on? For viewers abroad, Norman Tebbit is a very right wing, and I don't mean in the sort of, you know, fiscally right wing queen and country kind of way. He's right, he's pretty unpleasant individual. I feel my Norman Tebbit is yeah, anyway, let's not get into, but he was depicted by Spitting Image rather brilliantly in a sort of leather jacket with a yes, leader, which tells you all you need to know. And I remember this being quite revolutionary, this, you know, the 360 hologram, which is a brilliant, again, a beautiful touch from Graham Harper. He is really pulling out all the stops to make this visually interesting. The lighting is excellent as well. And then you've got this brilliant bits here where you have Christopher Gable as Shara's Jack, who you don't really see in this episode, but you see little snatches of. You see his sort of slightly over hairy hands. They've got, you know, I think they've done something there as well, which is really interesting. That you know, again, it's the sort of attention to detail. And I believe the talking to the camera was actually a miscommunication from director to actor that they decided to stick with, and I really like it. I don't mind being slightly less than naturalistic if it gives a story its own unique feel or dynamic or edge, and I think that this does. I think the colours are all beautiful as well, the way that they've got the window and the colour seeping in from behind. It's really sort of beautifully composed, everything. His, you know, it's not just his feel for action, Harper. It's his compositions, it's his colour schemes, and this is great. You know, this is he's using a very, very small space, and filling it, you know, and a single camera there really at the top. Yeah, so there's just two cameras on this. Yeah, it's and you know that the you know, you feel like the action is being perpetrated by people who've done, you know, people for whom this is in, this is what they do. This isn't just a load of actors doing this. And I think the casting, I remember thinking that Maurice Reeves was the real deal. And I was convinced at the time that. Well, I'll talk about Krelpa later. Again, that shot of Chelak in profile with the other two in the background, absolutely fantastic. And this is very much, you know, what Caves of All is all about. Chelak has essentially acknowledged that the Doctor's been set up, and it's like, yeah, but tough. I love Robert Glenister's android acting. We don't know he's an android yet, but he's slightly dispassionate. He's also slightly askew, which I rather like. And I love that that thing about you know, death under the red cloth. And this is brilliant. That way that the camera moves, sort of follows them, but slightly jerkily, and the music as they're being sort of shoved out and prepared for execution. And then you cut to this scene in the lift, which is just done by lighting and these brilliant two profiles of these two characters, essentially lying to each other, but knowing that they're lying and acknowledging their lie. It's glorious. Glorious. And oh, and here we're having the setup of, we're having all the exposition about what Spectrox is and what it does, which again, I think is sort of all rather artfully deployed. This is great. This is great. And again, this is just, you know, one camera on a small part of the set, but it's the way that the camera jerks up like that. And what they're doing there is obviously they're getting rid of their arms because they're having to beat a hasty retreat. That leads to what the sort of schism between them and Jack later on, where he says, you know, we had to dump the stuff, which is the sort of thing that happens, that doesn't often happen in dramas, but that happens in this one, because it's got a view to a wider picture. And I mean, the way that all of the information is being thrown in is very, 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 very good, and it's very, very grim, and yet it doesn't lose its sense of humour. And I think Nicola Bryant is great in this, the sort of gentle way that she's trying to come to terms with the fact that she doesn't feel very well and that they're about to be killed. I think there are different ways to play this, and I think she plays it, you know, really intelligently and very real and not histrionically, and I think it really, really works. Love this dynamic between this pair. And I think she's terrific. She's terrific in this. And Davison is excellent. He's such a good actor. He's it's just a great story, this, isn't it? Sorry, I'm going to be very boring. I'm going to try to be more interesting, to just say, that's good, isn't it? And that's good. But also, you know, I don't want to be, let's look at the bits I don't like. That's great. Again, it's just the little bits of, it's like a graveyard. Just again, that's drama, and then it fades, like the look on the Doctor's face, then the fade to an excessively hairy hand. I think they must have added hair to Christopher Gable's hand just to make it more interesting, alien, whatever. And you know that, and of course is a slight contrast to his very sleek, you know, leather clad figure. And that's, you know, this costume is superb, and this. I remember when I hadn't remembered this from the first time I watched it, but then when I got it on video, and you're like, this is what people talk about when they talk about Graham Harper. And it's just a montage, but this is not a usual thing for 1980s or any sort of classic series Doctor Who, really. And it's atmospheric, and it's, you know, it's helped by the sparse music. There are, you know, this is Roger Limb, who did Arc of Infinity, you know, which is you know, where the music bounces off all four corners of the universe and into your ears, you know, whereas this is it's, you know, it's minimal, it's atmospheric, and you're getting Jack, you know, whispering just the odd thing here, just dropping you in these little bits of information and atmosphere. It's you can find out what it is. You know, it's nothing is wasted here. Nothing is, you know, this first episode has been sort of non-stop without being breakneck, because it's had thoughtful moments and it's had quiet moments, and that I love that, because you go, oh, is that something happened there? You know, it's not enough to, well, it is enough to make you sort of go, so they have escaped the cliffhanger that's to come, but it's sort of half there. It's like a shadow in your mind where you go, so then when next week it's confirmed, or in the next week you go, no, because I sort of knew that, but I still think it doesn't undermine the cliffhanger. It does two things at once. It's clever. David Neal is excellent casting, because he does have the air. He does come across as somebody that is older than he looks. I find that difficult to explain, but you know, this idea that he's been taking Spectrox, so he's 25 years older than the 35 years older than he actually looks. I think they've thought about that with the casting, and you know, he's bottom of the credits, I think, David Neal, and it's a really good performance. And he was the lead in a thing called Noah's Castle, which was an ITV drama with Seth from the Horns of Nymon and General Hermack from the Space Pirates and David Neal. And it's basically about economic collapse and stockpiling. And I think David Neal I think there's a suggestion that he would sell his daughter to General Hermack. His underage daughter. So it's not what you'd expect of an ITV drama. Stockpiling and paedophilia for due to economic woes. And this is great. I love the dynamic between these two. You know, he is the president. You know, it's all going on there in Morgus's eyes. Normington's so good. He's such a good piece of casting. And this is such a fantastic sequence. Again, I think slightly undermined by the fact that they're in, building site gear, because because they've got the sword, haven't they? And they've got the military music. Now, of course, you know, these are androids now. This is how this is explained. But we don't, you know, we're not 100% convinced. And we clearly Jek's been up to something, because otherwise why is he laughing? But at the moment he's a mysterious presence. Look at that, absolutely fantastic mask design there. And I love this whole exchange about the red cloth is for soldiers. You know, a filthy little swine like that shot in the back. It's believable world building colouring, and it's so economical, and it says something about those two characters. It's very plausible, even though it's not something that we have or do, but it's enough rooted in our worlds of ceremony and militarism and all of that sort of thing, and how we, you know, deal with death and all of those sorts of things, and formalize it and ceremonialize it. It's clever writing. It's a cut above. And I remember this from being a kid. This was, you know, it's just a, how boring is a doctor facing a firing squad cliffhanger, or kill them now cliffhanger, except it's machine guns and they fire and they're all shot in profile and it looks like the bullets are coming out, and it's a fantastic cliffhanger made up of pretty, you know, staple ingredients of Doctor Who. I love it. I think everything about that episode, apart from the shambling bat cloak beast, is and the fact that opening scene between the Doctor and Perry doesn't quite make sense, because some of it's been robbed of context. What an excellent episode. What an excellent, excellent episode. how, what am I going to choose as my thing for my favourite thing? Well, let's have a think. The obvious headline for me with that episode, the whole story is Graham Harper. Graham Harper, he's matched very well to the... to the material, you know, if you are doing a Doctor Who story, which is, you know, Robert Holmes at his dark sort of macho, you know, with Douglas Camfield being dead and not anywhere near Doctor Who, because actually he died in 84, wasn't he? So he wasn't dead when this was being made, or around this time. Anyway, doesn't matter. Douglas Camfield, you would have had Douglas Camfield. I mean, John Nathan Turner wouldn't have done anyway. But you know, with Douglas Camfield not directing it, you'd want somebody, you know, cut from a similar cloth. And Graham Harper, you know, learnt a lot of his trade under Douglas Camfield, and sympathetic to the way that he did things, and stylistically, you know, there are similarities. So, you know, this is a fairly Douglas Camfield-y script with sort of mercenary type figures and, you know, a bit of violence and, you know, well-drawn hard men kind of characters that require good, if not flowery, but not too flowery actors. And Harper immediately comes in and makes a statement, and that includes, you know, the use of machine guns, the use of handheld cameras, the use of much sparser music, mood music, rather than, you know, an overabundance of radio, of clattery radiophonics, the colour composition, the softness of the colour palette in places, the filming and design in the caves and the mist, so much going on. I think going into this, I was going to choose the fact that it's machine guns, because I love that cliffhanger. So I was going to choose the cliffhanger, and then I was going, well, what does this cliffhanger speak of? It speaks of that choice to use machine guns instead of lasers or single shot guns. It's the fact that they're machine guns. It makes it feel more visceral. You can feel the sort of hot bullets, you know, flying out. The hot bullet casings flying out. You can, there's a visceral directness to a, you know, to being torn apart by a volley of machine gun fire than there is to, you know, a zap from a laser, which seems slightly more sort of clinical, less visceral, and we're slightly removed from that. So I think it makes it immediately more, you know, immediate and contemporary and threatening. You can feel it. So close you can feel their firepower. But watching that, there are just so many things. Like when, you know, they're bundled out of Chelak's office and the camera follows them and that music pipes in. The montage sequence with Sherrick, there's so much of it that screams Graham Harper is doing so much more than a lot of people are doing at this time. So much attention to detail, so much energy, pace, keeping it going. There's not a static moment, even in scenes where a lot of people are talking, because of the way he's framed it, because of the way that he's made the actors be a little bit more direct, or a little bit more terse, or a little bit more sort of biting or edgy. There's a real sort of undercurrent of viciousness. You know, it's an uncompromising world, and everyone's a bit, you know, everyone's scrape their knees and bang their elbows, or, you know, has a cough. You know, it's just real, and it's a harsh reality that, you know, never loses sight of the fact that it's Doctor Who, because it has a sense of humour, and because it's exciting, because it's a bit scary. But so I think I have to, and I don't know if Erica's playing it like this, because Erica was one of the first people I asked to do it, so hadn't heard anybody else do this. So I think she may have just gone for certain scenes or Peter Davison, the way Peter Davison did this and the way Peter Davison did that. But watching that, I cannot, in all conscience, do anything but go, Graham Harper announces himself so profoundly with such an impact as this director is so suited to this material and is elevating everything or responding to what's already good and doing it justice and serving it well. It's got to be Graham Harper. It has to be Graham Harper. What is Erica's thing for episode one?
What my favourite thing from this story is the cliffhanger at the end, obviously at the end, because I really believed when I was a child, I really believed that the Doctor had been shot. So much that I wouldn't go into school the next day. I kicked, screamed, I would not go into school because I thought the Doctor was dead. So now, looking back as an adult on that, it just brings back those memories of the fear and belief that I thought the Doctor had been shot, and it just goes to show how scary and how well done it, how good it was done.
Ah ha ha ha! So the thing I was going to choose, the thing I went into it thinking I was going to choose. That's interesting, isn't it? That both she and I, that had been our thing from when we were kids. I remember that cliffhanger. I remember the angle I was watching it from, the chair I was sitting on, the room that I was in. It wasn't a room in our house. It was a room at the local vicar's house. And I remember exactly where I was. And I didn't have to wait. As I say, we watched the whole thing in one go. But I still remember thinking that was an absolutely shocking, memorable and brilliant cliffhanger. And it's because of the way it's shot, because of the fact that it's machine guns, because it's built up through that ceremonial thing and the beat of the music. Oh, and it's just a Doctor versus a firing squad. It's just a kill them now. There have been infinite numbers of those. I remember thinking at the time, you know, this is a traditional kind of cliffhanger, but oh, whoa, not it's a cliffhanger, Jim, but not as we know it. And so I went into this episode knowing I was going to choose that. Then, but it was just Harper touch after Harper touch after Harper touch. And now I sort of go, yes, I wish I had chosen the cliffhanger and why didn't I stick with my guns? But I had to be honest to my reaction to what I saw then. And there were just too many bits that owe their greatness to Graham Harper. And because this is his first episode of Doctor Who, I think he has to get that nod. He is head and shoulders above almost everything that surrounds him in a, you know, five-year radius, really. But I, you know, I acknowledge Erica's choice of being a very that cliffhanger, which sort of owes everything to Harper. It really does. On paper, I don't think it would have been. It's nothing like. It's in execution. It's much more than a sum of its parts. So, thanks to Erica for that. I'm one behind. But I can still claw my way back. But I can't beat the episode ending that has just been celebrated in this podcast. So I'm simply going to say, kill this episode, kill it now. Thank you very much for listening to Happy Times and Places, which is presented by me, Toby Haydock, and my special guest this time around is Erica Lear, who can be found on Twitter at ErikaLear3, and that's in Lear as in the king, not as in what creepy Doctor Who villains, often in Robert Holmes stories, do to comely female assistants. I'm grateful to Erica and to the many patrons who make these podcasts possible, and they include Stephen Moffat, Joe Ford, Matthew Speddings, Graham Slate, Matthew Simpson, Jonathan Appleton, Richard Thomas, William Haynes, John, Richard Patey, Catherine Armitage, Martin Cook, David Crewe, Ned Fountain, Ian Morgan, Lisa and Andrew, Neil O, Peter Burns, Peter Harness, Ronald Hayden, Rob Leonard, Christopher Meredith, Richard Straw, Neil Tate and Nick Tedston. The music is by Dave Gates, the artwork by Dylan Patterson. Did you like the way I read those names out and would like that kind of reading to be done to your name and stuff? Then go to patreon.com/Toby Haydock, where you can become a patron. What they do is they pay as little as £3 a month. It goes up to infinity. Nobody's currently paying infinity a month. And you support these podcasts. You buy me the time to do these and to hopefully do them as well as possible and as prolifically as 3 releases per week will manifest themselves, hopefully. 3 per week is what patrons get. Not always a podcast, sometimes stuff from my archive, sometimes special stuff. But I say 3 releases a week. There's also a picture of my dog every week that I don't count as a release. So you get something on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday and Friday. Usually an edition of a podcast like this. From £3 a month, every tier gets that. As you go up the tiers, up to infinity, there are other things, but most stuff, all the essential stuff, is available at the lowest tier. It's this new way of doing things, and I'm slightly reluctant and feel slightly weird doing it, but I'm told it's perfectly acceptable so to do, and there's quite a nice community that has sprung up, and people who very kindly supported these sort of, you know, freelance artist productions, or whatever they are. You can do that at patreon.com/Toby Haydock. If you can't sign up for a monthly commitment, I totally understand that. You can go to ko-fi.com/Toby Haydock. Same principle. You're buying me the time to do these properly. But unfortunately, there are no bonuses there other than the satisfaction of giving somebody a metaphorical cyberspace coffee in exchange for words in your ear. That's ko-fi.com/Toby Haydock. What costs you nothing, because I know times are tough and I think they're going to get worse, and I just hope that if nothing else, I can give you something pleasant to listen to as the world goes to hell, because it really is at the moment. But let's all stick together and try and be nice to each other, eh? And so all I ask from you, if this is what you find entertaining, this is what you're enjoying, presumably if you've got this far, if you don't like it, you really should have stopped by now. Just go and do something that you like. And if you do like this, if you could go to iTunes, Spotify, everywhere you can online, and give these 5 stars, 5-star ratings, really help to make these more noticeable. And if they're more noticeable, more people will listen, and if more people listen, well, that's, you know, that rewards the endeavor. That means it's, I'm not being daft putting so much effort into these things, but also, you know, it also might help somebody that doesn't know that these things are out there that might like them. You know, go, it's nice, isn't it, if you discover a thing that you like and you push somebody in its general direction, and you can do that. That costs you nothing. The 5 stars and perhaps a couple of lines of review as well, just to say what you like about the shows. That again gives something people to you know, focus on, and gives them an idea of what is in store for them. And don't say lots of ums and ahs, and in increasing senility as you get towards the end of each episode. If you could do those things, they cost you absolutely nothing but a little bit of your time. Time that I would be grateful to you for spending on my behalf. Thank you. And do you have friends in Manchester? Then you might like to tip them off about Excess Malarkey Comedy Club, which I MC every Tuesday. It's a bit ruder than this, and I don't usually talk about Doctor Who, although I'll occasionally throw a reference in, sometimes just for me. But if you're there, it'll be for you as well. Look, it's a lovely stand-up comedy club. We get all the best acts from around the country. Joe Lycett has described it as the best comedy club in the world, and he sometimes comes and tries new material and usually helps us out if we need a favour. He's a very nice man. But, you know, he's been playing the club since he was a you know, an unpaid open spot. And we have those on as well. It's a club where comedians develop their trade. And we don't let in stag do's, hen do's or office parties. And that's every Tuesday in Manchester at 8 p.m. It has its own Twitter feed at XS Malarkey, the letter X, the letter S, Malarkey. And it has a website, XSMalarkey.com. .co.uk. It's one of those. It's going to be one of those two, isn't it? It's a comedy club, XS Malarkey. Find it online. I'm very proud of it. It's been running for 25 years. That's my day job, doing the comedy. The rest of the time, I blather on about Doctor Who, sometimes professionally, sometimes not. I'm not sure what the difference is, really. But anyway, if you want to, you know, if you want some of that kind of thing, I'm on Twitter at Toby Haydock. Haydock is H-A-D-O-K-E, and these podcasts have their own feed at Haydock Podcasts. I'm also on Facebook. Go to the page that is not my personal page, the one that's for me as a performer, because I'm migrating all my work stuff over to that so that my personal page can just be for people that I know. But it's still me. I don't have people. It's not my secretary updating my diary and my calendar on the performer page. It's just, that's where I put the work related stuff. It's still me. You can still message me there. It will be, we'll be going, yes, Toby Haydock thinks it's just me. It's just me. So you can go to my page on Facebook as well. And I think that's all of the things. So yeah, do the things. I will keep this post-credit sequence slightly brief because I'm a bit tired and it is Christmas time and I'm trying to have some time off. But in order to have time off in the new year, I've got to produce some content to put out there on the aforementioned Patreon page. So I'm doing this now on my brother's wedding anniversary, which is between Christmas and New Year. I'm doing this aged 48, but by the time anyone hears it, I might be 49. It depends. I don't know. I'm shooting a TV show at the moment, not an exciting one, don't worry. But the last day of filming was supposed to be done before Christmas, and it's been delayed, and I'm now not doing the last day till the 20th of January. I was only actually contracted till the 10th, so I've actually had a little bit of extra money. That sort of luck doesn't normally happen to me, so that's very exciting. But it does mean that in the episode, I will leave a room aged 48 and then enter another one aged 49, and only I will know that. Although I think I might, because it's before Christmas and after Christmas, I think my tum might have enlarged somewhat. Anyway, yeah, I mean, if you're a non-patron, you're probably listening to this in about July. So this is very, this seasonal reference just, well, it just displays the difference between being a patron and being a non-patron, because you get these much earlier. But yeah, the reason for the brevity, it's not even brief, is it? I don't think I could be brief if I tried. Do you have any last words? Yes, and his execution date was delayed by several weeks. But anyway, I'm recording this in the hangover for Christmas, and I watched The Descent, which I'd not seen. So I'm doing all the modern films, because that's from 2006. I watched The Descent, which I really liked. Then I watched The Descent 2. Can you see a pattern forming? Then I watched The Hole. It's basically lots of people going underground. And now I'm watching Case of Androzani. That's not deliberate. This was next on the list. Swapped with a Hartnell at the fairly last minute before Christmas, because I knew I just wanted to do one that I could kind of rattle off, really. But again, I don't think I could rattle anything off. If I tried, this is me not rattling. And then I did Severance, which is by a Doctor Who writer, James Moran, who wrote Fires of Pompeii, which is another sort of group of largely British character actors getting picked off in a sort of low-budget horror way. All films on their own terms that I found rather enjoyable. And I don't know why I'd never got round to watching them. And I've watched four films in one day. This is the first day I've not done anything apart from, I haven't even done much around the house. I've done a bit of the washing up, but I've tried to indulge myself. Do you know what I mean? I've tried to spoil myself She has been in bed, she's not poorly as such, as I mean, she's always poorly, but we've lived separate lives today. She said, do you want me to come down? I said, I'm quite happy watching horror films, because she doesn't really like horror films. So I've had quite an indulgent day, and then just at the end of it I went, well, shall I get an episode in? And that's what this is. So it's been a very cavey day, but I'm now going to descend back into some me time. And I'll emerge, because I get very claustrophobic, sooner rather than later.